This is Voices from Appalachia Radio Show, sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. I'm Brian Staggers, and here's your host, Bianca Eisen.
Last week, we revisited one of two presentations by the Nature Conservancy that took place at Shepherd University on February 28, 2022. The event was sponsored by John Dupree and Sarah Reynolds in cooperation with the Byrd Center for Congressional History and Education, Lifelong Learning, the School of Environmental Studies, and the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities, Shepherd University. Community partners included the American Conservation Film Festival, the Potomac Valley Audubon Society, and the National Conservation Training Center. We revisited Restoring an Iconic West Virginia Ecosystem, Status and Outlook for High Elevation Forests in West Virginia, which focused in particular on the red spruce trees, and presented by Mike Powell, who serves as Director of Lands for the Nature Conservancy in West Virginia. We'll be continuing looking at the Nature Conservancy this week as we hear from Thomas Miney, a Shepherd alumnus who has served as Executive Director of the Nature Conservancy in West Virginia since 2015. On his presentation, Resiliency in Appalachia, Conservation, Climate, and Community Action, we begin with a reintroduction to the Nature Conservancy and touch on some of their lesser-known work.
If you follow the history of the Nature Conservancy, we've been around since 1951. We've been a group that's been well-known as a land trust. You know, if you look across West Virginia, if you go to those iconic places in West Virginia, like Bear Rocks at Valley Sods, or if you're over here at Yankauer Preserve, not too far away, just over on the Potomac, which the Potomac Valley Audubon Society manages for us, and or if you go down to the southern part of the state and you go to the New River Gorge, we've been engaged in protecting some of the most iconic landscapes in West Virginia. And folks really know the Nature Conservancy for that. And they know the Nature Conservancy for some of the red spruce work that Mike talked about. So, you know, I think that land trust side of who we are is well known. But there are multiple levels of work that the Nature Conservancy does. And here in West Virginia, we're starting to embark on a lot of work around how does our mission serve the people of West Virginia, as well as how does it serve the plant and animal and natural communities of West Virginia. So I want to make sure as we go into this presentation that that's really laid out as part of what the Nature Conservancy is becoming as we learn, moving from those individual protected places into embedding those places into a landscape that has to be functional around it to embedding these ideas into the communities and into people's livelihoods around them to make our mission and our outcomes even greater as we go along. So just to recap, the Nature Conservancy is one of the world's largest environmental organizations. We're in all 50 states here in the United States. We have active or partner work in, I think, something between 72 and 70, I get the number wrong, somewhere in the 70 countries around the world now. And a lot of what you'll see today is based on the work that we do to prioritize and to really focus on our two major strategies, which is tackle climate change and protect the lands and waters that are important to us.
Miney shows a map developed in 2001 that shows the locations of biodiversity hotspots in the United States and Hawaii. The places with the most biodiversity are shown in red, while the amount of biodiversity decreases to green, blue, purple, and gray, with gray having the least amount of biodiversity. While the western part of the United States has several spots of moderate to high levels of biodiversity, Miney emphasizes that east of the Mississippi River, most of the hotspots, and particularly the hotspots with the most biodiversity, are located in Appalachia.
I want these things burned into your brains here, folks, because I want you going out and repeating this. I want you to know the position that West Virginia and Appalachians holds in the world. In West Virginia, we're kind of used to being at the bottom of the list on a lot of stuff. Well, we can go right to the top of the list when we think about what our role is in protecting biodiversity, what our role is in protecting ecological services for the people of the eastern United States and the world. So let's start at what people often know about West Virginia and the Central Appalachians, and that it's a resilient and connected diverse landscape, yes, but why? So let's talk about that. This is the foundation of what the Nature Conservancy is. We were really founded around this idea that protecting rare, threatened, and endangered species is a core part of our mission. And so we put this map together back in 2001. When we look at biodiversity hotspots across North America, and particularly weighted towards endemism. So endemics are species found specifically to the habitat. So here, because of the landscapes that we have, and because of the many microclimates and geologies that we have a lot of endemic species. And so you can see that red peak coming up out in here in the central Appalachians and occupying much of West Virginia right up through here in the eastern panhandle. So we have like the Cheat Mountain, that's not the Cheat Mountain salamander, but we have things like the Cheat Mountain salamander, which occur nowhere else on Earth but here, and multiple plants and fish and species that occur nowhere else. And so we have a really big role if we want to protect these rare, threatened, and endangered species. This is a place in North America to be focused on that protection.
Appalachia also serves as one of the remaining locations for temperate mixed forests. Once having covered half the United States and Europe, these forests have largely been decimated over the past several hundred years. Miney goes on to talk about the resiliency science that the Nature Conservancy uses to determine where they should most effectively focus their efforts.
But I want to go into how we really determine what it is that we're going to protect, where we're going to focus our efforts, and where we think those efforts are going to pay off over the long term when we think about biodiversity protection and the protection of functional landscapes, those landscapes that can make sure that those species can persist even under great stress like climate change. And so there's a body of work which Mike showed you some examples of earlier called our resiliency science that was put together through our staff scientist, Dr. Mark Anderson, out of our Eastern Science offices, that helped us determine and take a look deeply at what is it that we would use to create this blueprint or this roadmap of where we should be focusing our efforts and protecting and putting our dollars to protect and make sure this functionality continues. So there are a couple of factors that we need to think about. The first is representation. So if we look at the soil types, the geologies, how the land is actually made up, that's a predeterminant in many ways of what can occur there and what the intensity of biodiversity can be, given the fact that they have lots of options or lots of different places that they can occupy that are hospitable to them. Yes, so they have a lot of choice here in the Appalachians. Anybody that drives from here to central West Virginia and takes a small child that gets car sick knows you go up and down and around a lot, right? That up and down and around and a lot represents those various representations of the landscape that give home to a lot of different species. So not only do you have a lot of different options if you're a plant or an animal about where to live and how to live here, you also have factors that are surrounding you that's going to create this that's going to help you with your resilience, and particularly in the face of climate change. So the first thing in that resilience is what we've talked about. We've got a lot of those microclimates that you can live in, dependent on your place on the landscape. And second is whether or not you can actually move around and get to places that you need to be. If your place becomes inhospitable, can you go to a new place? Or is your place that you're living in functional and hospitable to you because it's at the size or scale that it needs to be? So let's take a little bit deeper look in that then. So if we think about how do you break that down into getting a representational map of where that landscape diversity is and where those microclimates are, you can look at a few factors. Elevation, geology of soils, landforms, wetlands, create this diversity across the landscape.
Miney shows another map of the United States that shows the amount of landscape diversity across the country. An arrow points to a dark green section of West Virginia, which shows to have up to 19 different microclimates.
And as you can see, as the map is outlined here, if you point down into, well, you can see the arrow points right at West Virginia. So you can see that intensity of green that's there in the central Appalachians. So that means we have a lot of this landscape diversity. And that's one of the reasons that we have this high level of biodiversity in those peaks that you see. So if we think about what that means off of the map and in the map, so at the top you can see that diversity, and then you can see that we can score that out by our resilience score too, if we think about how the connectivity is intersecting with that across the landscape. So when you stand on any mountaintop in West Virginia and you get the long green views, the long green is part of that, right? That's the connectivity. You're seeing those big intact forests. That's a major driver for making sure that when we see temperature changes happen, that land, that plants and animal species can move north on that landscape if they need to, if they're looking for those more hospitable places. But it's not just about moving north. I think the conversations get oversimplified, right? We think, oh, well, there's a tree species in North Carolina is going to end up in New Hampshire or Maine. It's not that simple. And these pictures are meant to represent that. You've got many different elevational gradients. You've got many niches in this environment, right? So part of the reason that we have a red spruce forest in West Virginia is because when red spruce moved from Canada down to Alabama during the last ice age, they could move back and hang out here on the mountaintops that were hospitable in West Virginia. So basically, we're trying to be able to think in that eonic way, like how do you put those places and how do you keep those places intact that are going to allow that to happen again? If things need to move around, where are you going to have places for things to hang out? Where are you going to have places for things to move to? And when you look at West Virginia's geography, you've got multiple places. It's not just north to south. There are elevational gradients and there are temperature variations that are important. There are precipitation and hydrological regimes that are important. And you've got all of these different niches that need protecting. And you've got the big green. And that big green isn't everywhere when you think about the landscape, particularly Mike showed a slide. I didn't put one in, but if you look out west, there's a lot of big green, right? There's a lot of public land. There's a lot of unoccupied forest space, big expanses. Here in the east, people think we don't have those things because you think of in the east, you're thinking Philadelphia, you're thinking Atlanta, you're thinking New York, you're thinking of Boston, or DC metropolis that comes all the way almost out to here to Shepherdstown. But the truth of the matter is there's still a lot of intact landscape here in the east that we need to be moving on and making sure that we're protecting because it's gonna have these factors that are gonna be important to making the footprint of evolution in the east sustainable. So I wanna repeat that again. If you don't have these factors, if you can't hold this together, from the Southern Appalachians to the Northern Appalachians, keep those places intact and keep that resiliency, we are going to impact evolution in the East differently than if we do have it intact.
The importance of Appalachia as a highway for migration can't be understated, as Miney shows another map tracking migration patterns of birds, mammals, and amphibians, with a circle just above West Virginia, where the flow of migration through the region is most heavily concentrated.
In many ways, if you're going into deep science, this is an oversimplification, but it's a very elegant oversimplification. It's got a lot of data compilation around mammals, birds, and amphibians and how they move. And in this broad representation, this is what the Appalachians is. It is a super highway of diversity and movement. So what happens when you make a barrier in the middle of the super highway? Everything stops. And so our goal is pretty daggone simple. It's very complex, as you could tell from Mike's work. It's complex work, but the goal is pretty simple. If you get in the middle of the highway and it falls apart, that all falls apart. That elegant map becomes inelegant. That clear movement does not become as clear. And now let's think about it as West. You know, not I'm here representing the Appalachians tonight, but also the West Virginia State Directory. Right? Yeah, I mean, you could, right below that circle that's on the map is West Virginia. That is a huge amount of importance that this state holds for holding that whole chain, the whole of evolution into the changing climate forward together.
Breaking up that migration superhighway would result in an increased competition between different species to survive. Not only in terms of resources, but doing so would disrupt migration patterns that have helped species to survive in other times of climate change.
I think if we've got the landscapes that are big and intact, you continue to have the many niches that you have, that competition is going to stay at a range that's not going to wink everything out, right? It's going to have places that they've still got the broad landscape, you've still got the broad connectivity, you still have many options. The more we break the landscape apart, the less options you're going to have, the higher the competition for those things are going to be. If you think about the last ice age, the reason things can continue on beyond the last ice age is things revamped and moved around is because there were lots of options. Now, if you think about our options across the landscape, here in the Appalachians, we still have a lot. But the more and more those get encroached upon or lost, the less options they are, the higher the competition, the more we're going to see species wink out. So that means we want to be able to manage and continue forward in that, to give those options. If we delve into the science then and think about where is that connectivity and climate flow, how do you start prioritizing across the landscape? We can start narrowing down where those really, really important places are. Now, if you're sitting in West Virginia, the whole darn place starts looking is pretty important, right? So that's something to be happy about because West Virginia is highly important to the whole Appalachians. And we can boil that down even further then is like, how are we looking at that resilient connected network where we need to focus our actions and think about where we're going to put our work on the ground. And when you start putting filters like urgency around those and start mapping that, you can see where we really hone in on where the most urgent places. And then if you pull out what is already protected, you get even, you know, a more concise roadmap of where the Nature Conservancy, where people like yourselves and others should be focusing their efforts to make sure that entire chain is held together best. Because there are a mosaic of different things across the landscape, protected lands, unprotected lands, lands that are at risk. And we need to think about it in that way.
This is the Voices from Appalachia radio show. We are revisiting a presentation by Thomas Miney, who serves as executive director of the Nature Conservancy in West Virginia, entitled Resiliency in Appalachia, Conservation, Climate, and Community Action. Returning to Miney's presentation, he begins to touch on how these environments benefit the people who live in the region.
So let's shift over into the people side of why the Appalachians are important. But just to remind you, when you're thinking about what those big green long views provide, it's not just pretty. It's extremely important to the quality of our own lives as humans as well, beyond the intrinsic value of nature and that long green view. You know, this is providing oxygen. The forests here, these big intact forests, provide a huge amount of oxygen. We'll talk more about water in a minute, but when you look at source water, this part of the world provides a huge amount of source water to a very big part of the United States population. It's generating a large amount of recreational dollars. That's really important to the economy here in West Virginia. And we've got 56% of above ground carbon here in the United States, when you think about that. So below ground carbon is a couple things. Coal is a below ground carbon that were forests hundreds of millions of years ago. But there is also below ground carbon that's captured by trees that are put into the soils. So Mike mentioned in his talk earlier, these photosol soils. So if you think about the red spruce forests, they capture and they actually fix carbon into the soil. So that's why they're important. So most people know that trees store carbon in their stems and branches, but trees can also put carbon into the ground for permanent storage as well. And so that's a really important component of carbon cycles that we don't talk about very often because they're complex. And it mitigates 1.3 million tons of CO2.
As CO2 is a contributor of global warming, a member of the audience asks Miney what effect rising temperatures will have on Appalachia.
Global warming will make stress on Appalachia. The question about what we do to make sure we maintain those large intact landscapes and the forest functionality will determine on how bad that stress plays out and whether it will get worse. Do we see things changing? Yes, we see things changing. But I think what I would focus on is what actions do we need to be putting into place to manage that change over time so that absolutely something will be in a different place than it is now, 100 years from now on the landscape. But is it still persisting? Are we still maintaining these large ecological functions is the question. I think Mike summed it up. I loved this quote. I was going to use it. You gave me the chance to use it. Mike made this up. I'll never let it die now. is let's not think about the forest of 100 years ago or 200 years ago. We're actually thinking about the forest of 100 years from now. What are we trying to build in so that forest 100 years from now is resilient, that forest 100 years from now maintains that suite of understory species? And how are we going to design that while we're trying to capture some of these other goals?
To expand on their preservation efforts, the Nature Conservancy has delved into larger land deals, such as the Cumberland Project, to maintain that resiliency network in Appalachia, but has also made efforts to get smaller landowners engaged in carbon markets as well.
We have to build on our roots as folks that have done land deals and take that to the next level. So we've been focusing on where are the large transactions that we can do that make huge differences in one transaction. And the manifestation of that is the Cumberlands. If you can look this up, nature.org, and type in the Cumberlands Project, you'll find it. You know, we've moved from individual tracts of 200, 1,000 acres to buying, you know, 253,000 acres at a time in big projects. That's a $130 million deal. To do that, you have to function differently than a traditional land trust. You have to know how to bring impact capital. You have to bring the partnerships together. So we're challenging ourselves to get in this space. If we want to really fill in that resilient and connected network, how do we make sure we have the skills and the people and the capacity and the partners in place to be able to do lands at that scale? And those lands at that scale count for diversity. They count for forest carbon. They have forest carbon projects on them. And you're going to learn more. They count for community as well. For here in the Nature Conservancy, we've got sort of an on-the-ground action focus. We have a program where we do large carbon projects. So that deal that we just talked about, the Cumberland deal, 253,000 acres, a lot of that's in forest carbon agreements. So that's providing not only a benefit of the land protection, it's also providing the long-term carbon contracts that make sure that forest is managed for carbon outcomes. And for small scale landowners, it's difficult to participate in those markets because it takes a lot of dollars to get yourself ready to participate. So we've worked with Amazon and we've worked with the American Forest Foundation to put together a program called the Family Forest Carbon Program. And basically what that program does is try to scale down the size of entities that can be engaged with getting the revenues from the carbon markets. So we match small scale landowners into the Family Forest Carbon Program. So in West Virginia, which it just launched this year, and Pennsylvania launched a year and a half ago or somewhere thereabouts, we're now being able to go down to landowners at the 100 acre scale or 200 acre scale, as opposed to the 10,000 or 25,000 acre scale. So that allows us to really think about how do we expand the sequestration that can happen and getting people, normal people, engaged in the forest carbon markets and also finding them an economic benefit for that engagement, right? So it's part of not only doing the good stuff on carbon, it's part of winning the hearts and minds of people to know that the low carbon future may have a place for them as well. And of course, there's policy engagement. So, you know, at the national level, we're always debating in the U.S. how we can push forward on climate action, how we can push forward on renewables, anything that contributes to lessening or lowering that carbon footprint. And we're engaged there as well, making sure that we're giving input at the federal and state level when that can happen.
While preservation is a main goal of the Nature Conservancy, the organization does take into consideration how their projects benefit the local economy in other ways.
We are not nature people with a line in between. We're nature and people. And so the outcomes that we look towards are not mutually exclusive. When we think about land protection projects, forest carbon projects, we think about renewable projects, that's going to be towards our end goals of managing for protecting those important places or managing the amount of carbon that's out in the atmosphere. But there are ways that we can think about our children's future being enhanced by conservation action, where they're going to get a benefit that's not just the intrinsic value of nature or managing climate change. We can think about how we think about setting a vision and a goal for our economies to be more integrated to provide services and income from those type of low carbon future options that we have. So there's tremendous potential to connect the well-being of people and nature and create outcomes that serve nature and people if we think about these projects from an integrated way and set both goals at once. So here in West Virginia and across the central Appalachians, we have an emerging concept that we call our nature and economy approach. And so when you think about the fact that we're undertaking projects to tackle climate change, and you think about the fact that we're undertaking projects to protect land and water, we can think about what is it that we do to design those or vision those, that they also contribute to the economic diversification for a place like West Virginia, or an economic gain for people that want to participate in a new economy or what we're seeking to provide. So examples of that then are like solar on mined lands. That's a new thing that we can integrate into our visions for the work that we do that's going to have outcomes that are good for the low carbon future, but are going to provide construction jobs, or they can provide community solar projects. Timbering for outcomes around carbon is the same thing. The timber industry doesn't have to go away because we do forest carbon. Forest carbon agreements require a plan for getting to the best carbon outcomes, which includes the ability to timber and manage that timber, right? And recreation is in the mix too there as well. So we've been promoting this nature and economy approach. When we think about West Virginia, we might think about the long green views there in the background is all we talk about, right? Because we talked about that resilient connected network. But we have these places that are on the land, like this mined land that people think about liabilities, that we want to turn into an integrated vision. So the vision shouldn't be, we don't want to work here, we only want to work there. It's more about how do we think about this, not only protecting the resilient connected network, but how do we think about what's integrated in and across that network, and how can we put it to work for the other goals? So if you think about a concept, you can take like the Cumberland's track, that concept is going to pull in multiple things. It's going to have big protection of the forest areas. Some of those might end up in public ownership. It's going to look at what can we do on former mine lands for reforestation. And then we can think about, you know, forest carbon projects and something like solar on those mine lands is also feasible.
You can find Thomas Miney's full presentation on Shepherd University's YouTube channel, or learn more about the Nature Conservancy by visiting their website at nature.org. Thank you all so much for joining me, and until next time, I'm Bianca Eisen.
Voices from Appalachia Radio Show is sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University, with the following created to enhance and develop the cultural and economic life of West Virginia and the Appalachian region. Academic programs that include an Appalachian Studies minor, an interdisciplinary BA, BS undergraduate degree, and a graduate certificate and master's degree in Appalachian Studies at Shepherd University. Celtic Roots and Global Appalachia Study Abroad and Celtic Heritage Series. The Appalachian Heritage Writers in Residence and Writers Award, which support the West Virginia Center for the Books, One Book, One West Virginia, Common Read Selection. The West Virginia Fiction Competition. The Anthology of Appalachian Writers, an annual anthology featuring writing by the Heritage Writer, and poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, essays, and photography created by Appalachian writers across the region and the world. Voices from the Misty Mountains, NEH, and West Virginia Humanities Council Teacher Institutes, Shepherd Speaks StoryCorps Project, and this radio show, in cooperation with Shepherd University Public Radio Station, WSHC-FM. To learn more about our degree programs or upcoming events, visit us at our website at shepherd.edu/appalachian, or at our Facebook page, Appalachian Studies Program at Shepherd.